From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, headaches, migraine, cluster, tension, sinus. Just talking about them can give you one. Dr. Fred Cheftel is a headache expert. He'll tell us how we get them and what to do for relief. Also today, the Tony Award-winning star of Stephen Sondheim's latest musical, Passion. We meet Donna Murphy and hear excerpts of the forthcoming cast recording. And TV critic David Bianculli previews the new PBS sitcom, The Stephen Banks Show. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. The UN mission in Haiti says it's been ordered out of the country by the military-backed government. A spokesman for the mission says the UN will decide later today whether to obey the order. Alan Tomlinson reports from Port-au-Prince.
The 100-member UN mission is here to pursue a diplomatic solution to the Haitian crisis, as well as to monitor human rights abuses. This morning, it received a diplomatic note from the military-backed government accusing it of aggravating the Haitian crisis by slandering the de facto regime and its human rights reports. Mission spokesman Eric Fault said the mission has been given 48 hours to leave Haiti in order to avoid any provocative incident that might lead to U.S.-led military intervention here.
For the time being, we have only relayed the information to our headquarters in New York and in Washington, and we're awaiting their instructions.
The special UN envoy to Haiti, Dante Caputo, said in New York the expulsion order was an outrageous decision that amounted itself to a provocation. In Haiti, I'm Alan Tomlinson reporting.
Vice President Al Gore says the United States is committed to restoring Haitian democracy. He told CBS today that Washington will go on pressuring the Haitian leaders to give up power and let ousted President Jean-Bertrand Aristide return to govern. Gore says a U.S. military invasion of Haiti is not imminent, but it's still an option. He says the U.S. hopes to solve the Haitian crisis peacefully through stricter sanctions. The Clinton administration has been criticized by some members of Congress for a confused Haitian policy. North Korea has put off its summit with South Korea following the death of former President Kim Il-sung. No new date for the talks has been set. The BBC's Philip Short reports from Seoul.
When Kim Il-sung's death was announced on Saturday, the outpouring of grief was spontaneous and genuine. The tyrant had gone, but he was the only tyrant most of his subjects had ever known. But now, as the crowds grow larger and the grief ever more hysterical, it's being orchestrated and choreographed as political spectacle. Soldiers weep and prostrate themselves on the ground as proof of their fervor and loyalty to the regime. Women stand red-eyed, beating their breasts. Everyone must weep. Not to do so would invite suspicion. Only the leaders remain silent and unseen. No senior Politburo member has appeared in public since Kim Il-sung's death, though his son and expected successor, Kim Jong-il, is reported to have received heads of diplomatic missions when they went to pay their respects to the dead leader, whose body is now lying in state.
Philip Short reporting. President Clinton has dismissed Senate Republican leader Bob Dole's criticism of his condolences on the death of North Korean leader Kim. The president says his remarks were appropriate and in the interest of the United States. On Wall Street, the Dow is down 11 points. This is NPR. Plans are underway for the biggest design overhaul of the dollar in 65 years. Officials say the availability of high-quality color copiers and scanners is making the dollar more vulnerable to counterfeiting. NPR's Greg Peppers reports.
The dollar's main design was standardized in 1929 to include uniform portraits and random security fibers. The last change to the dollar was in 1991. The government introduced security thread and microprinting to the $100 bill to guard against counterfeiting by sophisticated copiers and printers. The polyester security thread is embedded in the paper on the left side of the note's face. The strip cannot be reproduced in the reflected light of a copier. Calls for changing the greenback come from Capitol Hill and elsewhere. Lawmakers contend that bogus dollars circulating abroad could be used by terrorists to bankroll their causes. The Treasury Department is tight-lipped about the new dollar. A department spokeswoman would only say the changes will be noticeable. Speculation has surfaced that the changes may involve bigger portraits moved to one side of the bill, as well as the use of different colors or watermarks. The revamp will cover the 6 notes now in production. Treasury says there are no plans to recall the existing currency. I'm Greg Peppers in Washington.
A major interstate freeway is open in Georgia. I-75 had been closed for several days because it was underwater. State transportation officials say the last closed lanes were opened early today in Macon. Interstate 475 has also been reopened, but the flooding isn't over. Waters continue to threaten the city of Bainbridge. Colorado firefighters say they hope to bring the Glenwood Springs fire under control today. That's the blaze that killed 14 firefighters last week. The fire charred more than 1,800 acres on Storm King Mountain. It was surrounded by fire lines over the weekend. Crews put out small and isolated blazes that remained yesterday. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. If you suffer from headaches, there's probably a few phrases you hate to hear, like, big deal, it's only a headache, or, it's because you're too neurotic or compulsive, you just bring it on yourself. My guest, Dr. Fred Schaftel, is director and co-founder of the New England Headache Treatment Program at Greenwich Hospital in Stamford, Connecticut. He's also the national president of the American Council on Headache Education, which goes by the acronym ACHE. He's going to share some of the latest medical information on the cause and treatment of headache. This is also covered in his 1990 book, Headache Relief. His group, ACHE, has just put out a new resource book called Migraine, The Complete Guide. Dr. Schaftel hates the expression, it's only a headache. He'd like everyone to have more respect for the suffering headaches often cause.
I think that there are a lot of myths about headache, and I think it's important that people understand when we're talking about the kinds of problems that we'll be discussing today, that migraine, for example, is not just another word for headache. It is not just another headache. It is a debilitating disorder, really, of the central nervous system. And I think there are a lot of people out there who have your garden variety tension headaches or tension type headaches who think that these other sufferers who really suffer with incapacitating pain are weak or neurotic or simply don't have the kind of tolerance for pain, just take 2 aspirin, come to work, and make the movie, etc.
Give us a sense of what people go through when they have migraines.
Well, generally, there are 2 broad types of migraine. Most people are familiar with what we used to call classical migraine or migraine with aura. Now, that represents maybe 10 to 15% of all sufferers with migraine. Those are the folks who start off with some dramatic symptoms such as visual changes. They may see flashing lights. They may see zigzag lines. They may lose part of their vision. They may have what we call field defects and not be able to see off to the periphery. They may have other symptoms involving funny feelings in their arms or legs. And that may last for a half hour to an hour, not more, and that is then followed by the headache. Now, the headache phase, which is common to both people with classical migraine and what we used to call common migraine, now called migraine without aura, usually starts as a dull ache, generally is throbbing in quality and is one-sided, and over a period of hours builds up to a point where the pain becomes incapacitating. Usually there is a degree of nausea and sometimes vomiting with these headaches, and the sensitivity to light and sound is so profound that some people cannot even look at the digital display on a clock radio because of what it does to their heads. I remember one little girl who talked about her light sensitivity to her mother by saying, "Mommy, the sunshine is in my head."
So do most people who suffer with migraines have to basically stop work, stop doing anything when they get an attack?
Well, I would say that most people who suffer from migraine really may have more moderate attacks where they're able to push through the day, though their productivity is much decreased. I mean, they may be at work, but they're there physically, and the amount of productivity is much reduced. The kinds of patients that we may see in our office are clearly those who are totally debilitated and incapacitated, who cannot function at all. But the majority of patients with migraine will suffer some degree of debilitation. And in fact, most people with migraine do not know that they have it. There has been a large-scale epidemiological study that was done fairly recently, which clearly showed that 60% of all women who suffer from migraine have never been diagnosed as having it, and 70% of men. Therefore, the majority of people with migraine believe they have something else, usually involved in self-care with over-the-counter medication or what I like to call off-the-shelf medication.
How much do we know about the cause of migraines?
Well, we've learned a lot more about the cause of migraines. You know, starting at the very beginning in the earliest recorded writings about headache, of course, we believed that headache was due to demonic possession. Over the years, that's been modified, thankfully, and we've had a number of different theories of migraine, many of which have involved changes in blood vessel activity. Nowadays, what's beginning to become clear is that migraine is indeed a disorder of the brain, of the central nervous system. It represents a cascade of complicated and complex neurological events, which involve changes in biochemistry. A lot of work has been done recently on the role of serotonin, a key chemical messenger or neurotransmitter in the brain. And the final common pathway involves changes in blood vessel activity on the surface of the coverings of the brain. I think it's really important that your listeners understand that migraine is indeed a biologically based disorder, just as valid as hypertension or angina or ulcer or any other disorder. And that biological basis is now being clarified.
Well, now that the biological basis is being clarified, is there a better sense of what kind of medical treatment to use?
Well, yes, there is. I think that especially in the last decade, there have been there's been a lot of research. Most recently, the newest kid on the block, so to speak, is a medication which is known as sumatriptan, which is the brand name Imitrex, which is available now in the United States by a self-administered superficial injection. This drug was developed in the United Kingdom based on what our current understanding of migraine was involved in terms of the kinds of receptors that were found on blood vessels. And this medication was developed to specifically affect those receptors and works quite well. There are other mediators in the brain that are being investigated right now and will pave the way for better pharmacological therapy, ultimately better preventive therapy. And in fact, we also know that migraine is clearly a genetic disorder. 70% to 90% of people with migraine have a first-degree relative with it. This summer in France, French researchers presented a paper, past summer, August of 1993, presented a paper where they are beginning to localize the gene for migraine, or rather they found the chromosome, so that as we understand more about the genetics of the disorder, ultimately, like a lot of other medical disorders, as we're able to affect and manipulate genetic material, the disease will ultimately fall.
How much do you prescribe things that will help either ease the discomfort or take a person's mind off of the pain, such as biofeedback or meditation, breathing exercises? I don't know.
Well, an awful lot. I mean, the treatment of migraine should not be exclusively based on pharmacological therapy.
Mm-hmm.
And the way that we position this is by saying, look, migraine is a biological disorder. Picture it as a stick of dynamite with a fuse. Then there are a variety of factors which you can look at as matches which can light this fuse. Now, here are some of the triggers that we believe are operant in migraine. Hormones in women is an important factor. We know that before puberty, the prevalence of migraine is greater in boys than girls. As soon as menstruation becomes a factor, it goes up 2.5 or 3 to 1. We know that a lot of women will have some of their more severe headaches around their periods. We know they may get worse on oral contraceptives. We know that they generally tend to do better during the last two trimesters of their pregnancy. They may do a little worse around menopause and a little better after menopause. So hormones is the reason why the frequency of migraine is higher in women than men. It's not based on neuroses, dependency, or the other kinds of things that they've been accused of. Diet is an important factor. There are a variety of foods that we know can trigger migraine. The most commonly mentioned food trigger, if you can call it a food, for migraine is alcohol, particularly red wine and beer. There are a number of foods which we ask our migraine patients to eliminate for at least a month. They include alcohol, freshly baked bread products, which contain a lot of yeast or something called tyramine in them. We ask them to avoid nitrites and nitrates, which are contained in processed foods. We ask them to avoid MSG. And we also have found that NutraSweet or aspartame, an artificial sweetener, can be a trigger in up to 50% of patients with migraine. So we want them to look at their diet. We want them to have a reasonable diet. Another factor which can be involved in triggering migraine are changes of any type. For example, changes of seasons, changes in weather, storm fronts moving in, altitudes, changes in sleep schedule, skipping meals. So these are factors that we review with patients and help them to make some changes in their lifestyle. And certainly last but not least is the role of stress and psychological factors. And what's important to understand is this. If you do not have the biology for migraine, no matter what you are like as a person, type A, type Q, type E, uptight, not uptight, relaxed, etc., you don't get migraine. But if the biology is present, certainly one's behavior can affect this disorder.
Can regular headaches worsen and become migraines?
Yes. Many people who have migraine may also have tension headache at time as well. In fact, many people that we will see have something called chronic daily headache, and these poor people suffer from headaches on an almost constant or daily basis, usually mild to moderate in nature, going on throughout the entire day, and then superimposed on that, they may have episodes of migraine as well. Now, an important point I want to make here in this, if I can, is to say that many of these people of chronic daily headache are overusing over-the-counter medications. There's a phenomenon which is known as analgesic rebound, and in fact, we now understand that for people who are taking pain medication on a regular, if not daily basis, they will absolutely make themselves worse, and they will not be able to respond to the usual kinds of techniques that are involved in treating headache.
So this is if you take aspirin or ibuprofen or acetaminophen?
Exactly.
All of those?
Exactly. And we also include, though they're prescription products, any of the pain medications. Mm-hmm.
So why do these medications make it worse if you take them regularly?
Well, we know that when people are taking these medications on a regular basis, they can affect mechanisms in the brain adversely. There's nothing wrong with taking these medications on an occasional basis, but for people who are taking these medications four or more times per week, they run the risk of this phenomenon of rebound, where the medication has its effect, begins to wear off, and over time pain comes back and more medication is required. The reason that this happens in the majority of people with migraine, and the majority of them do have migraine, is that they become so concerned about any little headache becoming their major debilitating attack that they start to medicate very, very early. In fact, some of them will take medication the night before to make sure that they don't have a headache the next day. And the proof is in the pudding, Terry. When we take these people off of their medication, 50% or more will respond with 50% decrease in their headaches within a month. And within 3 months, 80% to 50% improved.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Dr. Fred Schaftel, and he's the director and founder of the New England Headache Treatment Program. He's also the president of the American Council on Headache Education, which is also called ACHE. Dr. Schaftel, let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more.
Fine.
This is Fresh Air. My guest is Dr. Fred Schaftel. We're talking about headaches. He's the director and founder of the New England Headache Treatment Program. What causes the basic tension headache?
Well, again, there are two thoughts on tension headache. See, when we're looking at pain and headache in particular, we have to look at both the brain, and we call that those activities central mechanisms, and they have to do with biochemical changes in the brain. And then we look at changes that may occur outside the brain, for example, in muscles. In people with tension-type headache, they may have both a mechanism that is occurring in the brain involving changes in pain chemistry, and they also may have excessive tightness of muscles around their head and neck and shoulders. So both mechanisms may be involved. But I must say that there is a significant percentage of people who complain of the kind of pain that we know is involved in tension-type headache, who, when we examine them and even measure muscle activity, do not show themselves to have high levels of muscle activity.
Mm-hmm. There are some people who get headaches on the weekend, on mm-hmm. a Saturday or on the first day of a vacation or something.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, I think, a fairly common phenomenon that is kind of difficult to explain. After all, that's when you're supposed to be relaxing, enjoying yourself, and rid of the tension that would and presumably cause a headache.
That's exactly right. And so, therefore, it really has nothing to do really with tension. Again, weekend headaches, or for example, let's look at weekend headaches. Weekend headaches occur basically in two people, people who tend to have migraine. And again, as I said earlier, migraine is much more likely to occur during letdown periods. See, when we're under stress and when we're kind of focused in an intense way, we secrete what we might call stress chemicals like adrenaline and steroids. And when we begin to relax, these stress chemicals begin to let down. This may have the potential of actually triggering migraine in predisposed people. There's another phenomenon that's important to look at related to weekend headaches, and that is the use of caffeine. If people are using caffeine regularly during the week in somewhat excessive amounts, they may get up later on the weekends. They will therefore drink their caffeine-containing beverage later, and that can lead to a caffeine withdrawal headache, which is easily taken care of when the person takes in caffeine. So the solution is either to get up at the same time, get your caffeine fix, or to begin to decrease and taper the caffeine that you're using during the week.
Now, you know, you mentioned that the adrenaline and other hormones that course through your system as you push to meet those deadlines or get the job done during the week, they're not there on the weekend, and their absence might bring on a headache. Do we become addicted to our own hormones?
Well, I guess in that sense, you can say yes. If you tend to be somebody that, basically functions in a very, intense and focused way, then certainly those chemicals are up there, and people may thrive on them. And then if they are able to relax on the weekend, they then may have a problem. But the answer is certainly not to keep up that frenetic pace of activity, because it's just going to wear you down. There are a lot of people who have type A characteristics out there, and when they're younger, they can get away with it. But as they get older, they will become more prone to fatigue and a variety of medical problems, and ultimately potentially can burn themselves out.
So what's your suggestion to prevent those?
My suggestion is to take a look at your level of intensity. Start to be more aware of things that you're doing without realizing it. For example, we have people do something that one can call a body scan. We ask them to look for signs of tension, scrunching up muscles in their forehead, clenching their teeth, clenching their jaws, haunching their shoulders, driving their cars with their fists clenched on the wheel. One of my colleagues often suggests to his type A that they try driving in the right lane. That's a very good exercise for type A people to do, is to do that and maybe put on the radio and learn to relax a little bit. Uh-huh. And work on that time urgency, that competitiveness. I mean, these are not bad traits. I'm not at all trying to suggest that we're dealing with negative traits, but people sometimes do not know how to turn it off. You see this all the time. I see people who not only work at work, but they work at play. I see people on tennis courts and golf courses who are supposed to be out there relaxing, and that looks like the farthest thing from their minds.
Now, I know there are certain foods that are triggers for migraines, and I'm wondering if there are foods, or alcohol, for instance, that could just trigger a much more low-grade headache.
Less likely to.
What about beer or wine? I know a lot of people who complain that they'll get a headache after one or two glasses of wine, especially if it's later at night.
That is more likely, again, to be more migraine, even though it may be mild to moderate, mm-hmm. than it would be to be tension-type headache. In fact, Terry, beer or wine or alcohol in somebody with a tension-type headache may actually be helpful, because it'll help them to relax, and alcohol may relax those muscles I was talking about earlier. But people who have a glass of wine or beer and have a headache, the likelihood is greater that they have migraine. Now, of course, everybody who may drink excessively from time to time may have what most people have from time to time, and that's a hangover headache.
Mm-hmm.
And anybody who's had one of those has an idea of what migraine can be like.
You know, I have to say, some of the things that you're telling us might be scaring some of our listeners into thinking that what they thought was just an ordinary run-of-the-mill stress headache is actually a mild migraine. To me, that's a frightening thought, because migraines, I don't know, they sound like such hell, and it's such a more major problem than an ordinary run-of-the-mill headache. Should we be scared if we think that, from the way you're describing it, maybe it's a migraine?
No. I mean, even if it is a migraine and people are getting away with living with it, as long as it's not interfering in any major way with their functioning, their activity, their quality of life, if they can take over-the-counter medication from time to time and that does the trick, that's fine. It certainly is nothing to be frightened of, but for those folks who do have the more debilitating varieties, yeah, I mean, it does affect the quality of life, and they certainly should be in seeking out some treatment.
There's a third kind of headache that we haven't talked about. That's the cluster headache. What's the cluster headache?
Cluster headache is a monster. It is a headache that is more common in men than women. The pain of cluster headache is always one-sided. It usually involves the eye and the temple. It is not as much a throbbing pain as it is a boring pain. Probably the most vivid description of cluster that I've heard is being similar to a red-hot poker being driven into the eye with immense force into the brain. The eye on the same side of the headache will close somewhat, the lid which will drop. There will be some tearing. The eye will become red. The nostril becomes stuffed and runs. Now, these attacks are shorter than migraine. They may last, for example, 30 minutes to an hour, but they may occur several times a day and almost classically will awaken the person 1 to 2 hours after they go to sleep at night. It may occur for cycles of 6 to 8 weeks in a person's life, never again, occur once a year, every few years, and for a very small percentage of unfortunate people, there are 10% of people who have what we call chronic cluster headache. The pain is so severe that, as opposed to the migraine sufferer who retreats to a dark, quiet room and tries to sleep, cluster patient cannot sit still. They're standing up, they're pacing, they're driving their fist into their eye. It's a very, very dramatic headache. And of patients that I've seen who have had cluster, who have also had migraine, who have had gallbladder disease or kidney stones or labor, when you ask them to look at those pains, they will clearly state that cluster is the worst pain they ever experienced in their lives.
Well, that sounds pretty horrible.
They've been called suicide headaches, too, because certainly if people thought for a moment it would not end, it would be a very reasonable position to end their life.
I think a lot of people assume there's no point in going to a doctor for a headache.
Well, that's absolutely wrong. If you decide that you have to learn to live with these things, then you are really sacrificing the quality of your own life. And you do not have to wait until you're debilitated, till you're overusing medication. If you're having headaches, let's say you have a migraine that's either taking you out or decreasing your productivity, let's say once a month. Well, that's 12 days out of your year. I mean, if you're prepared to be ill for 12 days out of the year, that's fine. You know, that's your choice. But there are so many new treatments, medications, non-medication therapies that are available, so much more that we've learned about headache, that I want the take-home message on this interview to be something for that don't learn to live with it. Seek out appropriate help. There are people now all over the country that have taken up headache as a specialty, who are well-versed in diagnosing and treating these disorders. If you are not getting very far with your doctor, or you find that your doctor is not sympathetic, or you cannot communicate with your doctor, or your doctor doesn't listen, there are other doctors who will. And resources such as the American Council for Headache Education can give you names of people within your area who would be interested in working with you.
Doctor, what do you do when you have a headache?
When I get a headache, I generally will see what's around my clinic and make a choice. I do it haphazardly the way other people do. I can take any of the over-the-counter medication, or occasionally if I have a bad headache, there's a very mild prescription medication called Midrin, which I've used from time to time, and that's very helpful.
But you'll choose from among the three basic types of over-the-counter painkillers?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Okay. Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
My pleasure, Terry.
Dr. Fred Cheftel directs the New England Headache Treatment Program at Greenwich Hospital in Stamford, Connecticut. He's also the president of AACE, the American Council on Headache Education. His 1990 book is called Headache Relief, and his group AACE has just put out a new resource book called Migraine, The Complete Guide. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, we hear excerpts from the forthcoming cast recording of Passion, Stephen Sondheim's latest musical. And we meet Donna Murphy, the actress who recently won a Tony for her starring role as Fosca. It's a role that requires her to look sickly and ugly. And TV critic David Bianculli reviews The Stephen Banks Show, the new PBS sitcom. The executive producer is former NBC executive Brandon Tartikoff. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. The United States has condemned the decision by Haiti's military to expel human rights observers from the United Nations and the Organization of American States. The observers have 48 hours to leave the country. UPI's Carol Van Dam reports.
Without going so far as to say the expulsion of human rights observers constitutes an act of war, U.S. officials are warning Haiti's de facto regime their patience is running thin. The State Department's Christine Shelley.
The expulsion of the International Civilian Mission, the ICM, is certainly a serious escalation in the conflict between the regime and the international community.
Shelley says Haiti's military is sending the message that it will not tolerate any scrutiny of its human rights record. Their cynical action, she says, is a clear indication that Haiti's human rights situation is deteriorating even further. Carol Van Dam, Washington.
Diplomats who went to view the body of the late North Korean leader Kim Il-sung say they were personally met by his son, Kim Jong-il, but he reportedly didn't say a word. Reuters News Service is quoting an unnamed diplomat who says Kim Jong-il received the group. He was followed by the North Korean defense minister and then the premier. Kim Jong-il is still being referred to as the dear leader. His late father was referred to as the great leader. The elder Kim was president and general secretary of the Korean Workers' Party. Kim Jong-il has long been his father's designated successor. The foreign ministers of France and Britain will travel to the former Yugoslavia tomorrow in an urgent attempt to convince both sides in the Bosnian War to accept a new international peace plan. NPR's Andy Bowers reports.
British Foreign Secretary Douglas Hurd and his French counterpart Alain Juppé will travel to the region as Bosnia's Serbs and their Muslim Croat adversaries decide whether to accept the country's partition. The two sides have until July 19th to accept or reject a map of the partition drawn up by Russia, the U.S., and European leaders. Bosnia's Muslim president has already said he will recommend that his parliament approve the plan, which would give his side 51% of the country. Bosnia's Serb leaders have expressed more concerns over the map, which would force them to give up a good deal of territory, but they have not rejected it outright. The French-British visit is designed to underscore Western threats that this plan is the last chance for a peaceful settlement to the long war. Britain, France, and Canada have hinted they will pull their peacekeeping troops out of Bosnia if this effort fails. I'm Andy Bowers in London.
Seven East European technicians were murdered today in Algeria. They died in two attacks. 51 foreigners have now been killed in Algeria since Muslim militants escalated a campaign to cripple the Algerian economy and topple the government. Last week, assailants slit the throats of seven Italian sailors who were docked in port. On Wall Street, stocks closed lower. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 6 points to end the day at 3,702. This is NPR. Eli Lilly and Company says it'll buy McKesson Corporation's PCS Health Systems. PCS is the nation's biggest manager of prescription drug benefits. The deal is worth $4 billion. Lilly is one of the country's biggest pharmaceutical firms. Analysts say this is another step in the rapid consolidation of industries that make and deliver drugs to consumers. They say this is part of this is spurred on by the movement toward national health care reform. A new survey of business, labor, and academic leaders finds the U.S. economy is growing more competitive, but it still faces major challenges. NPR's Laura Kanoy reports.
A survey by the Council on Competitiveness says the U.S. is making progress in staying competitive, but still faces what one executive called a lengthy struggle. The Council is a nonprofit group of business leaders, union officials, and university presidents. In the survey, members warned weakness in public education will undercut U.S. competitiveness. They said improving the nation's schools should be the government's top priority for the next 5 years. According to the Council, other threats to competitiveness are the low U.S. rate of savings and investment, the federal budget deficit, and a need for better worker training. Survey participants pointed to some trends they said will boost future U.S. competitiveness. They said exports of manufactured goods were strong in 1993, labor productivity was up, and companies invested more money in plants and equipment. This is Laura Kanoy in Washington.
A record flood has peaked in Albany, Georgia. Authorities say the Flint River crested this morning there at 44 feet. That's 24 feet above flood stage. It's expected to stay that way for several days. The flood tide is now headed for Bainbridge in southwest Georgia. There, the river is 10 feet above flood stage. About 3,500 people have evacuated from low-lying areas in the city. Disaster centers have opened in several areas. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Stephen Sondheim's latest musical, Passion, recently won 4 Tony Awards for Best Score, Best Musical, Best Book, which went to James Lapine, who also directed the show, and Best Actress in a Musical, which went to my guest, Donna Murphy. Passion is adapted from the 1869 novel Fosca and the 1981 movie Passione d'Amore. The story is set in 19th century Italy. It's about a young army captain named Giorgio who's having an affair with a beautiful woman. Their happiness is ended abruptly when he's transferred to a remote army outpost. His commanding officer there has a cousin named Fosca who is sickly and ugly. Although she is reclusive and rarely leaves her bed, she becomes passionately obsessed with Giorgio. In this scene, Fosca manipulates Giorgio into writing a letter that she dictates, in which he declares his love. From the forthcoming cast album of Passion, here's Donna Murphy as Fosca and Jerry Shea as Giorgio.
Fosca, it will be light soon. I should be going.
Would you do me a great favor before you leave? Would you write a letter for me?
Certainly.
My dearest Fosca, please.
My dearest Fosca.
I wish I could forget you. Erase you from my mind. But ever since I met you, I find I cannot leave the thought of you behind. That doesn't mean I love you.
That doesn't mean I love you.
I wish that I could love you. I know that I've upset you. I know I've been unkind. I wanted you to vanish from sight. But now I see you in a different light. And though I cannot love you.
Donna Murphy had to get rid of her good looks for her role as Fosca. I asked her how the script describes Fosca.
What was written in the script was an astonishingly ugly woman.
Mm-hmm.
That she's very, very ill. She's very frail. The bones in her body and in her face are so prominent that you're struck with how close she is to death. And when I first read the script, I It's funny, I had forgotten until I recently looked at the script once more that they referred to her as astonishingly ugly, because I chose to focus on the illness and the loneliness and a kind of defense and that she has built up about herself and about how she knows people tend to perceive her.
You play her as very homely, but not very ugly.
Yeah, I mean, we made a choice not to go crazy with prosthetics or, I mean, there are a few things that they chose to do in terms of, I do have a couple of moles, well-publicized moles.
That's right. Are those moles large enough for the last row in the house to see?
Apparently not. Apparently not.
Well, you know, I'm wondering, when you read this script before you auditioned and said, you know, astonishingly ugly, bones so prominent you could tell she was going to die, did you feel that you had to go into the audition looking astonishingly ugly?
I made a choice to focus, again, on the weakness. I went in, I wore no makeup, I slicked my hair back, I wore clothes that were kind that made me feel like I was lost in them.
What'd you wear?
I wore a long black skirt and just a gray kind of loose blouse, and that really revealed my neck, which is thin, and I can kind of work it in a way that it looks, well, really thin. And
thin and anguished?
Yeah, there you go. And I remember when I auditioned that the casting director up at Lincoln Center, where I was working on another show, I was doing this other workshop at the time of Hello Again, and he came out to bring me in to the audition room, and he didn't recognize me. And I really hadn't done anything drastic. But and actually, another story is that when I showed up to rehearse with Paul Ford, who is works with Paul Gemignani in the music department. He's a fabulous pianist and has worked with Steve Sondheim on a number of shows. And I had rehearsal time with him before I came to my audition. And he said when I came in, he didn't recognize me. And he just immediately had a sense that I was going to play this character. I said, I must have looked really bad, you know?
So what song did you sing in the audition?
I was asked to prepare Fosca's entrance, which was kind of overwhelming, but immediately evocative. You see, I did not see a full script. I never saw the words astonishingly ugly.
Oh.
That what I was given were a few scenes, some later scenes in the piece, and that piece of music. And I was asked to prepare those for my audition. And I only had one audition, and I didn't hear for a couple of weeks. I mean, I thought it was a very good audition, but I had to wait in suspense for a couple of weeks before I got final word.
You know, I'm thinking you've probably done a lot of auditions in your time, but not always auditioning for the actual composer of the song that you were singing. And that must put an extra special pressure on you.
Oh, yeah, particularly when you walk in and Mr. Sondheim informed me that this would be the first time he ever heard this piece sung.
Oh, you know, I was wondering about that.
And I just remember saying, just wanting to, like, crawl through the floor. I mean, now I say that and I think, my God, what an exciting opportunity. But in that moment, like, I didn't feel like I was under pressure enough. The thought that this would be the first time he hear those notes coming back to him, you know, out of someone else's mouth.
Yeah, and I should interject here that, I mean, Sondheim isn't a great singer. So if he sits at the piano and composes it, I mean, he doesn't have the range of someone who's truly a singer. So even singing it himself, he wouldn't hear how it would sound when say, someone like you would interpret it.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm sure he heard
I say this with the greatest respect.
Right.
I love Sondheim's music.
Yes. Well, and interestingly enough, the music comes in, when I got the music, when it was in a much higher key, and yet I remember asking, do they want, you know, a very, very high soprano? And they said, no, that's not the sound they're necessarily looking for. And to feel free to take it down, which I did. But I think he writes in a key that he can sing in.
My guest is Donna Murphy, star of Stephen Sondheim's musical Passion. More after this break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Donna Murphy, and she stars as Fosca in Stephen Sondheim's musical Passion, now on Broadway. I think the audience has a very complicated relationship with your character. Mm. In the audience, you feel sorry for your character. You have a lot of respect for Fosca because you suspect she has an inner life with a lot more depth than the other soldiers who are in the play. Yet you get annoyed with how intrusive and unrelenting her obsession, passion is for the man who she loves but won't return that love. I wonder how you feel about her and how you want the audience to feel about her.
Well, I think they should, in fact, feel all the things that you just described. And I think it very much mirrors what Giorgio feels.
Mm-hmm.
And that's important. When I first started to work on her, I found it very important not to judge her.
Mm-hmm.
And yet I in no way wanted to over-sympathize with her and soft-pedal or water down who she was so that people would respond in a sympathetic way. I wanted it to be an honest portrayal of this woman who was raw and mm-hmm. difficult. But quite honestly, in the preview process, when I would hear from some people that they just wanted to kill her or something, you know, just had real difficulty with her, I found it strange that they didn't find some part of her to empathize with or to have some of the other range of feelings that you talked about I think most audiences do have towards her.
In fact, I've read that at some of the previews, people actually laughed during some of the scenes because I don't know why. Maybe you could tell us. And I'd like to hear what it was like when you're on stage doing this character who on the one hand seems to have a deep inner life and on the other hand is very pathetic in many ways.
Right.
What it was like to be trying to portray all these complicated emotions and it must, I don't know, you're getting laughter.
Right. It was difficult. I found it frustrating and painful, and because when I was within the hour and 50 minutes that I perform her, I need to kind of stay on her track. I'm not obsessive about it, you know. Mm-hmm. I mean, if something happens backstage, I respond to it as Donna. But there, because of the need to walk into specific scenes in a real heightened state emotionally often, I can't afford as an actress to get off of her track. And so subsequently, I found myself really vulnerable to that laughter that sometimes happened, and particularly early on where I didn't expect it.
Mm-hmm.
During the workshop, we got some, and in thinking about it, realized it wasn't a bad thing for it to happen in some places. And as long as the audience could successfully make a turn
mm-hmm.
at the point at which Giorgio kind of makes a turn and see her and hear things that she said from a slightly different perspective, then we should allow them whatever their response is.
I want to play another song that you sing in Passion, mm-hmm. and this is called Loving You. And you sing this to Giorgio, the soldier who's stationed in this remote provincial outpost in Italy. And this is your explanation about why loving him not only is an expression of love, but it's giving you purpose in life. It kind
right.
of explains the obsession that we've been seeing
yes.
on stage. What would you like to tell us about the song, either technically or emotionally?
This is a song that came rather late in our preview process. James and Steve realized that both the audience and the character of Giorgio needed some kind of a revelation in the Fosca character that would enable them, and he being Giorgio, to see her in a different way and to help a kind of turnaround that happens in Giorgio where he moves from just kind of being repelled and disliking her to recognizing something different, something that gives him cause to look at her differently.
Loving you is not a choice, it's who I am. Loving you is not a choice, and not much reason to rejoice, but it gives me purpose, gives me voice to say to the world, this is why I live. You are why I live. Loving you is why I do the things I do. Loving you is not in my control, but loving you, I have a goal for what's left of my life. I will live, and I would die for you.
That's Donna Murphy. Now, we're actually hearing an advanced cassette that excerpts the cast recording that will be coming out very soon. How is Passion performing now at the box office?
Quite well, I think. I mean, the summer will be interesting in that, you know, we'll have a lot of tourists in town, and I hope they'll, you know, take an adventure with the show, because I think... It seems to be very moving to a lot of people, and I think unexpectedly mm-hmm. to some people. And I meet people outside the stage door almost every night, and very few of them are New Yorkers. You know, I've met people from all over the country who talk about just how moved they are by the piece and have a lot of questions about the characters and the process, some of the same questions, you know, similar questions to what you're asking me now. People are provoked by it. And so I hope that it continues to do well and that people kind of take a little leap with the show.
I'm just thinking that must be quite an adventure every night to step out of the stage door and not know who's waiting there for you.
Ooh, it sounds dangerous, doesn't it? It is. It's. I tend to take some time getting out of my drag.
Taking the moles off.
Yeah, right. And often there'll be people who I know who will come back, and I'll spend some time with them in the dressing room. So when I encounter people who have waited for, you know, a good 40 minutes or so out of the theater, I know that, well, they're very loyal and must have really enjoyed the show, you know. But it's exciting to meet people and to get, you know, truly objective responses to the show. So I enjoy meeting people, and it feeds me.
Well, Donna Murphy, I thank you a lot for talking with us.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Donna Murphy stars in Stephen Sondheim's musical Passion. The cast recording will be released later this summer. This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel's with us. Robert, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
Well, we'll hear about the first public appearance by Kim Jong-il, the son of the late North Korean president, Kim Il-sung. He appeared today as diplomats arrived to pay their respects, view the body of the late North Korean leader, and sign a book of condolences. It's his first public appearance in more than 6 months, and it suggests that indeed he is regarded as the man in charge in Pyongyang right now. Also, news from Haiti. The Haitians have expelled a UN-led human rights observer team. They have 2 days to leave the country. And also a report by Chitra Raghavan, who talked with a group of doctors and researchers in Cleveland about the AIDS epidemic and where it's headed.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. This week on most PBS stations, the network is premiering a new type of original programming. New to public TV, that is. TV critic David Bianculli has the details and a review.
PBS executives sometimes refer to themselves as the humor-impaired network, but that's just about the only joke they make. The last time PBS produced its own comedy series was in 1990, with a pretty good anthology show called Trying Times. The time before that, well, I don't know if there was a time before that, unless you count Firing Line. But for 8 weeks this summer, PBS is presenting a genuine sitcom. so genuine that one of its executive producers is Brandon Tartikoff, the former NBC Entertainment president who scheduled The Cosby Show and Seinfeld. This new series is called The Stephen Banks Show, and its obvious appeal is to baby boomers. Like Jerry Seinfeld, Stephen Banks is a comedian who plays a TV character named after himself. The Stephen Banks Show is about a guy who never left the 60s and who rarely leaves his apartment. The flavor is very much like Seinfeld, except with a lot more music, and except for the fact that this series actually originated long before Seinfeld hit the air. In the late 80s, Banks starred in a one-man stage show and Showtime TV special called Stephen Banks' Home Entertainment Center. He played a guy who had only a few hours to complete a report for work before his boss came by to pick it up, but who spent the whole time procrastinating, playing his drums, putting on mock concerts, and generally goofing around. That show was fresh and funny, and this is a reworked series version of the same general idea. The laugh track is way too loud, and the tension of the deadline isn't there anymore. But Banks is back, and that's good enough for me. He's a loose cannon like Robin Williams, except Banks does most of his impressions to music. In the opening episode, he buys what he thinks is John Lennon's guitar at a charity auction, but ends up buying Julian Lennon's guitar case instead. Big disappointment. Until he finds some sheet music hidden inside, signed to Julian from Dad, and plays it on his piano.
Yoko's driving me crazy. She's screaming in the hall. Yoko's driving me batty with a crazy caterwaul. She can't sing a thought she could. It may be art, but it's not good. And you know what I think as I sit here having a drink? Damn it all.
In the second episode, a friend invites him to a Bob Dylan concert, and Banks gets so excited he puts on a Dylan wig and fake nose, grabs a guitar and harmonica, and mounts a concert of his own, complete with special guest stars. He plays them, too.
How does it taste when your life is a waste? Like third grade paste. You're a complete disgrace. You know, there are a lot of friends here tonight. I introduced Steve. I'd like to bring another guy up here. Mr. Johnny Cash. Come on up, Johnny. Take a verse.
Well, you rode your chrome-wheeled, fuel-injected flexi flyer in the rain, and your sister's pinball pimples popped in parasitic pain. An engineer.
It's this simple. If those musical samples made you laugh, the Stephen Banks Show is for you. If not, it isn't. But Stephen Banks, the character, is the type of guy who can take part in a radio quiz and name Mason Williams' classical gas in three notes. And that makes him my kind of guy.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Daily News. This is our first show in about 5 years without Joan Tuohy on the staff, and we miss her already. They just don't make better associate producers. Smart, always open-minded, and very fair both in her treatment of stories and her treatment of her friends and colleagues. We were really proud of her when she took a leave of absence to work with South African journalists covering the election. Now, sadly for us, it's time for her to move on. We wish her luck with her new show and her new freelance career. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations. Additional support comes from the George Gund Foundation. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, The Crisis in Haiti, we talk with Patrick Belgrade Smith, chair of the Department of Afro-American Studies at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. He grew up in Haiti at the height of the Duvalier dictatorship. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.